Good afternoon. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Ewan Graham. I direct the International Security Programme here. Sir Lawrence Friedman is a name synonymous with strategy and strategic studies. He has been the Vice Principal of War Studies at King's College since 2003, and going back further than that, since 1982, a professor there. Those are two significant years for war studies in the UK, well chosen. Sir Lawrence has been a member of the official inquiry into the UK's role in the 2003 Iraq War, as the Chilcot Report recently released. He has also held numerous research appointments in Oxford at the International Institute for Strategic Studies and is a fellow of the British Academy. He spoke last week at the Australian National University at the 50th anniversary event of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre. So we're very fortunate to have you here. Grateful that you've made time for us. And Sir Lawrence will be speaking to us today on the theme of historical analogies in foreign policy making. Can we overlearn the lessons of history? He'll be examining the importance, the understanding and the origins of contemporary events and the meaning of historical experience, warning of the abuse of historical parallels and analogies. I've certainly used the 1914 comparison and traduced Munich many times. So I'm here to put us straight on that. Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Lawrence Friedman.
Thanks very much. It's always a real pleasure to come to the Lowy Institute and see old friends again. So the topic is can we learn too much from history? I'm sort of on the borderline myself of history and political science. And of course, it is our raw material, history. So those of us who spend time worrying about the future are always going to be drawn to the past because this is our raw material. It's our only source of hypotheses about how our system works, the best guides about how to act effectively. But history as a discipline is geared to the past, not to the future. It's about trying to reconstruct events and appreciating how they appear to the actors directly involved. Those who didn't know what was going to happen next, who could barely appreciate the great economic and social changes that were underway in their times, and perhaps had no more than an inkling of what was going on in the minds of their adversaries. Actors, in fact, very much like ourselves. We don't know, for example, how well the current Chinese leadership is going to be able to fight corruption, sustain the Communist Party's role, and manage the country's economic development, nor how far they're prepared to go to assert their position in the various disputes they now have with the Philippines, Vietnam, and Japan. We don't know whether Vladimir Putin is satisfied with the position he has carved out for Russia in the Ukraine and Syria, and his likely next steps. There is much speculation about whether he's got his eyes, say, on Estonia or another of the Baltic states. But how bold can he be in his foreign policy when his economy is in decline? How well will the nuclear deal with Iran fare? It depends on the Iranian leadership, or at least the more moderate elements in that leadership. Can they stick to their side of the deal without us being sure whether they can sustain their position and the deal itself in the future? Events in Turkey have recently shown how we could all be caught by surprise, including the president. While Saudi Arabia now appears to be under the influence of one of the more volatile younger members of the royal family. Closer to home, we know, at the very least, that President Trump will mark quite a significant departure from the past consensus that shaped American foreign policy. But it's not even clear that he knows what he will do should he become president, or how much attention he has paid to the actual decisions he would find himself making, and the impact that this will have on the alliances upon which both our countries rely. My own country has just agreed to break away from the EU without any real idea about how it's going to do so without causing immense economic damage. We're still trying to work out how this happened to us. Are we talking about poor choices made at the top levels, or just a complete failure to understand what was going on outside the homelands of the metropolitan elite, with all those people for whom who felt sidelined and ignored as a result of globalization. Was it a sort of revenge? So we don't even necessarily understand events of which we're a part. Meanwhile, not a day seems to pass without some sort of crazed individual causing mayhem, many inspired by an apocalyptical ideology that most of us struggle to understand. Now, future historians will bring perspective to these events. Now, they'll know how they ended, or at least the next stage in the story. They'll note our catastrophes and our near misses, what our leaders got right and what they got wrong, what we should have seen coming and what was bound to catch us by surprise. And they'll no doubt express sympathy at our failure to anticipate developments that we should have seen coming, the black swans, perhaps less so with a tendency to assume that the future would be very much like the past, that trends would continue uninterrupted. Until recently, you would find people who were assuming that 10% Chinese economic growth would continue almost indefinitely, and straight lines were produced that would show how this would propel China into its dominant role. Equally, one would see, often related to that, explanations of how demand was bound to push the price of oil up to $200 a barrel. Perhaps the greatest period where it was assumed that trends would just continue as the past came after what had been a remarkably striking departure from the past, which was after the end of the Cold War. But because this was such a benign development, there was optimism that history might now be progressive, that all the trends were pointing to the free movement of goods and capital, people and ideas, going to create a sort of global liberal democracy with one dictatorship after another falling. There was a brief revival of that sort of optimism in 2010-11 with the so-called Arab Spring, when popular movements were backed without really always a full understanding of their limitations or of the forces that opposed them. You may recall then the phrase about the importance of being on the right side of history, which captured the thought that tyrannies were bound to be overthrown and eventually replaced by polities that were more representative and open. But history doesn't have a right and a wrong side. How it unfolds depends on choices that are being made and are yet to be made. Nor does history tell us how to make those choices, although constant references to the lessons of history would make you think that this is our best source of policy wisdom. Despite all the warnings about the dangers of drawing inappropriate conclusions from past events, commentators on contemporary international conflict are constantly drawn to historical analogies. There's a natural desire to learn lessons from all the big things that went wrong in the past, notably the two world wars, and a few things that went right, notably the end of the Cold War. In some areas, this has become routine. Any attempt to negotiate with a disagreeable regime will soon lead to solemn references to Munich. The 100th anniversary of the start of the Cold War encouraged a number of worried comparisons between the events that led to that calamity and current relations between China and Japan. Prime Minister Abe was specific in asking about whether they were in a pre-World War I situation. So it became a sort of natural starting point for discussions about where that particular tension might lead. Yet the differences between Europe in 1914 and the Pacific now are enormous in terms of the issues in dispute, the respective alliances, geography, the nature of the military options, the wider economic and social context, and so on. Certainly it's useful to think about past wars to provide wise reminders about the need for diplomatic care at times of crisis, thinking hard about the consequences of any rash move, getting to know what you can about your opponent and trying to understand any country you happen to be invading. But such caution does not require always close reading of past events or tight comparisons with those events and the present. Sometimes it just requires looking hard at the situation in which you're in. It can also help, where it can be helpful, I think, is to help you understand how things have changed. The idea of the crystal ball effect, the ability to foresee how a conflict might develop, was said to be one of the most important consequences of the introduction of nuclear weapons. So the argument would be that if everybody had known in 1914 what 1919 would look like, they really would have tried to find a little bit more time for diplomacy. A bit more caution would have been in order, instead of being allured by plans of swift mobilization and speedy victories. With nuclear weapons, you have a reasonable idea of at least the worst that could happen. You know what the outcome of a war could be, and that is, in a sense, the more or less the basis of nuclear deterrence, that possibility of utter catastrophe. And it is the thing that makes a difference between the positions in 1914 or 1939 and in a sense, the whole period since 1945, what is now being called the Long Peace, not because the world has totally been at peace through this period, but because there hasn't been a World War III, there hasn't been another great power conflagration. So thinking about what's different from the past can be very useful, but that is not the same as seeing that it's by assuming a parallel. And actually, if you think about it, often these metaphors are, in a sense, metonyms, a shorthand way of making a point. Worried about a soft talk, and you'll gravitate to Munich. Fearful of the big stick, and you go to 1914. I don't think the constant references to Neville Chamberlain at Munich in 38 have much to do with fresh evaluations of the policy of appeasement or of the quality of the alternative options available to the British government at the time. Reference to Munich is just another way of warning against being weak and spineless in the face of a challenge from a dictator. Equally with 1914, the lesson is perhaps don't allow military timetables to set the pace, let an otherwise innocuous trigger lead to a global conflagration before the diplomats get a chance to exercise restraint. But it's essentially the case is being used as an illustration to reinforce a stance taken for other reasons. It's not so much that history often guides our policy choices, but the policy choices can be explained by reference to history as a sort of sample box of events that you can draw on to find a relevant lesson to reinforce the point. Need to keep a war limited. Recall how MacArthur's dash to the Yalu in 1950 drew China into the Korean War. Alternatively, worried about keeping to very restricted war aims, then note how Saddam Hussein was let off the hook at the end of the 1991 Gulf War. The 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis advises the provision of an escape route for your adversary, even while being firm, the so-called Golden Bridge, though not necessarily noting the very specific option to Kennedy to do this, because he didn't mind promising not to invade Cuba, because he had no intention, after the farce of the Bay of Pigs, of doing so. But in other cases, trying to help an adversary save face may mean offering them real concessions that harm your credibility with your own side. In other cases, Northern Ireland is available to show how terrorists can be brought into a political process, even though this was an unusually benign set of circumstances. This process can also be used to offer warnings about making sure that those with whom you deal can really speak for their organisation and can deliver on the concessions they will need to make. So, for example, the idea of having a conversation with the Taliban was often made by reference to the Northern Ireland experience. But the Taliban and the provisional IRA were very, very different beasts, with far more central control over one than the other. And even then, there were still breakaway movements with which it was necessary to deal. It's striking how so embedded some of these lessons are that they keep on going, even though you might think there's more contemporary disputes and conflicts that might provide more valuable guidance. Just think about the Munich analogy. You really have to imagine people in 1938 looking back to the Crimean War to get their lessons. It's that far back. We've had, of course, since in recent times, the experiences of Iraq and Afghanistan and now Libya and Syria. You've got Yugoslavia and Rwanda. We've got plenty of rich material from recent times that's worth looking at in order to see whether there are, in fact, more useful analogies or useful case studies that are worth examining that don't rely us to go back into very different periods of history. But talking about Afghanistan, there's quite a very interesting article that's just been published on the influence of historical analogies on the conduct of the campaign in Afghanistan by Paul Miller of the University of Texas. And he's pointed to two examples of the flawed use of history in this case. The first was the idea that Afghanistan was the graveyard of empires. This is one of those phrases that sounds like it's been around for decades and just a bit of old wisdom that was dredged up again when we suddenly found out that we were likely to invade Afghanistan, but actually seems only to have been used in the context of Afghanistan first in 2001. I think it had been used with Mesopotamia before that. And in fact, there's no particular reason to believe it was true. It wasn't a graveyard of empires. Empires had gone back and forth through Afghanistan without too much trouble in the past. There are some famous examples of the British getting into trouble in Afghanistan, but actually a lot of them were what was focused on one particular incident in 1842, which was overinterpreted, not least by assuming that there'd been a complete massacre of 16,500 crack British troops, when actually it had been largely a massacre of camp followers, Indian camp followers who'd been following about 4,500 troops of the East India Company, and actually was followed by quite a severe defeat of the Afghans by the British. British gave up on Afghanistan in 1919, not because they'd been defeated in battle or facing hopeless resistance, but they were just exhausted after the First World War and didn't really think it was worthwhile going on, just in the same way they decided in 1947 to get out of both India and Palestine, not because they couldn't cope, but there didn't seem to be any point in coping anymore. So there's nothing particularly special about Afghanistan as the graveyard of empire. Certainly the Soviet Union faced a lot of trouble there, but they fought a campaign in a particular way with particular objectives. Miller argues all this was misleading because it played down the actual strengths of the coalition position after the Taliban had been overthrown and exaggerated the difficulties the coalition was likely to face. The analogy encouraged the view that the Americans and their allies were bound to be viewed as occupying powers, when he argues there is evidence that at first, there was a much more positive reception. And many argue that this was reinforced by constant references to Vietnam, which were, if anything, more prominent with regard to Iraq than Afghanistan, because, again, it reinforced the view that the coalition was fated to fail because it just doesn't do interventions very well. But again, Vietnam was very different because of the resources that the Soviet Union could put into sustaining the North Vietnamese in their fight. And the problem, anyway, was for the Bush administration was not whether there was actually direct relevance, but any mention of Vietnam increased sort of a deep sense of national foreboding with regard to interventions of this sort. So this meant that the Bush administration tried to avoid practices that might otherwise have been associated with Vietnam, from too much civilian interference in target selection or even a bombing pause to allow the Taliban a chance to negotiate, because they were just too redolent of Vietnam. It didn't want any references to take root. Equally, when Obama was facing military requests for more troops, he viewed those in the light of those options that had been presented to LBJ half a century earlier, with the idea that this was really an entry into a quagmire rather than something being evaluated in its own terms. So wasn't really necessarily a belief that either Iraq or Afghanistan were analogous to Vietnam, but a reference to Vietnam signaled that these sort of things tend to end in tears. According to Miller, quote, US policymakers, informed by bad historical analogies, dramatically missed the opportunity to secure greater gains towards stability early on. In part because of their fixation with the graveyard of empires, the United States missed an opportunity to invest greater resources in the country when the Afghans were most receptive to it. Whether or not the tentativeness was encouraged by analogical reasoning, I think one can argue that the problem went wider, and that the American policymaking in 2001 was also too influenced by the experiences of Somalia and the Balkans, and that somehow it was inappropriate or unwise for the United States to get involved in nation building. He does seem to have a point that they didn't give enough thought to the consequences of failing to build up the economic and social and political structures of Afghanistan when they had a chance to do so, which the consequences of that are being felt. We can discuss how easy that would be, but certainly in 2001, 2, 3 and 4, there was not a lot of effort put into trying. Another example recently discussed was with Iran, where those who argued that the United States was taking too great a risk with the current Iranian regime warned against the assumption that somehow Rouhani was another Gorbachev, as if there was a parallel there. Now, if anybody was making that parallel, it was clearly going to be wrong, not least because Rouhani is not the supreme leader. And if you're trying to find a parallel with Khamenei and Gorbachev, you're going to struggle pretty hard. But you can at least ask the question about the challenge of a leadership facing a severe economic condition and attempts to cope with that, which can lead to developments that you can't control and take you to unexpected places. The point about Gorbachev, after all, was not that he knew where he was taking the Soviet Union to. He did not think he was taking it to its breakup and the end of the Communist Party. He thought he was reforming it. What it tells you is about the problems, the dilemmas that are faced if you, when you have a system which is dysfunctional and you set in motion a process of reform. Now, historians have long pointed to the pitfalls of the sort of reasoning I've been describing, but psychologists have also explained why it's hard to avoid. These analogies are testaments in some way to the limits of our imagination. And if we use them properly, we can identify possibilities that we might otherwise have missed. They provide a shortcut to help us navigate our way through uncertainties. But as I've also tried to stress, they may also be ways by which we bolster our existing beliefs and prejudices. Faced with an issue, we search for relevant examples to show why a particular course of action might succeed and another one might fail. These superficial parallels then don't expand the range of policy options, but instead narrow them down. It's worth recalling a judgment of a great historian, Ernest May, in 1973. Quote, policymakers ordinarily use history badly. When resorting to an analogy, they tend to seize upon the first that comes to mind. They do not search more widely, nor do they pause to analyse the case, test its fitness, or even ask in what ways it might be misleading. Seeing a trend running towards the present, they tend to assume it will continue into the future, not stopping to consider what produced it or why a linear projection might prove to be mistaken. So at best, these are shortcuts, devices to help us make sense of a complicated system, situation. What we are after are guides to causation, a way of saying the course of action will have such and such consequences. But history can't provide us with such guides. Comparing and contrasting two apparently similar situations can be fruitful, so long as the aim is to identify recurring dilemmas, the range of possibilities, rather than just say how this is how it will follow because the events are parallel. Along with counterfactuals, they can be ways of exploring causation and therefore of evaluating policy levers. The mistake lies in assuming that following the same policies will produce the same outcomes. In short, history should alert you to factors of which you should be aware, dangers that might be lurking unseen, possibilities that might be worth exploring, questions to ask. It can provide suggestions, but not rules to be followed. And of course, it's always important to remember that history itself is not agreed. You just have to look at the range of books that came out recently, in 2014, about the origins of the First World War, to see how much is still in dispute, even amongst historians. There isn't agreement on what these events were about, what were the important causal factors even in the past, which should be a reason for caution. So let me, to conclude, return to some of the current uncertainties and ask, in what ways might we use history to address, the question of China? Question I know in this part of the world is a major preoccupation. There are enormous range of possibilities about how relations with China will develop. How can history help us with this sort of this sort of policy challenge? Let me just suggest four or five. First, it's useful to be aware that these projections, presumptions about the latest great power have their own parallels. In 1988, some of you will recall, the coming war was not going to be with China, but with Japan. Paul Kennedy's book on the rise and fall of great powers is a very good example about how historians should be extremely careful about projecting into the future. Said nothing about the collapse of the Soviet Union, but lots about how how Japan was just going to get stronger and stronger and stronger because of the brilliance of its manufacturing techniques. So we've been here before, and of course, within years, Japan had entered a period of stagnation from which it hasn't really yet properly emerged. Secondly, look at the presumption that as you get stronger, what you really want is world domination. That is the sort of logic about a lot of the more excitable headlines. Undoubtedly, China is a country dissatisfied with the status quo that's geared to the needs of the United States and other its Western allies. But actually, it's not altogether clear that what China wants from this is to be a global power as opposed to a regional power. That seems to me one of the debates to be had rather than something to be taken for granted. And we shouldn't just assume that it's following an Anglo-Saxon path. We're very influenced by the fact that the United States took over from the United Kingdom. But this was almost deliberately tutored to do so with the similarities, not only in their background and language, but also in their role as maritime powers. So we tend we tend to assume that there's, if once you become very strong economically, you want to translate that into political and military muscle. And I think there's an argument within that China indeed would like to do that within this region, but not necessarily get it. Why would it get involved with the problems of Europe in the Middle East if it could possibly avoid it? What is the benefit for it of doing that? And it's got its own, and it has its own historical models, which it's, we need to understand as to what a regional hegemony might look like, which is probably different from an Anglo-Saxon model. So that argues then for actually the importance of history is to understand the history of those countries that, with whom you're dealing, rather than worry about whether or not contemporary China is reminiscent of Wilhelmine Germany. Try to make sense of its particularities on its own terms. How does Beijing view its own history, the slights and humiliations of past centuries? That's as relevant as whether or not there's something in the European past that gives us clues to its future behaviour. If all the great strategic virtues, I think, empathy is one of them, and to be empathetic with China, which is not the same as being sympathetic with China, being empathetic with China is to understand its history and how it views it. Recognise that history develops at the micro as much as the macro level. Too much of the focus on the great lessons of history focuses on dramatic turning points involving big decisions at the very top. It sort of encourages almost a great man theory of history, and without abandoning altogether the thought that decisions taken at the very top do tend to be influential and the most critical, when it comes to shaping and then implementing these decisions, actions taken by those with far less power can often be quite crucial. To understand the Chinese economy, or indeed any economy, it's necessary to drill deep into everyday activity. What's happening with employment, the extent of local debt, to see where the problems may be coming. If you're just looking at the very top, you probably will miss a lot. An example of where we got this wrong was Russia in the 1990s. Decrees were issued, plans were promulgated by people who sounded very much like Western economic policymakers, as if this was a functioning Western economic system, but of course it wasn't. And lastly, challenge your own assumptions. Don't assume that because you see a parallel, that's how it's going to follow. Keep checking. Keep looking at events. Try to understand the logic of a situation. For example, the position in the with the islands in the South China Sea and the options available, rather than assuming that once you enter a certain sort of crisis, everything else will follow as it followed in the past. And lastly, above all, remember, we really don't know how this story ends. Thank you very much.
Sir Lawrence has kindly agreed to stay on with us and take questions, and I'm aware that we've had a very good turnout at the Institute today, so I don't want to take away time from that for those present, but maybe just to get the discussion rolling. You took us, I think, very effectively towards the end of your presentation to a sort of set of principles, which I think we would like to try and hold ourselves to here at the Institute, very much in line with our own thinking about empathy with others, challenging one's own assumptions, but also being aware of the micro turning points of history and rather than a predetermined view. On the empathy point, I thought also it was very interesting that you had put yourself in the position of policy makers. Having been someone who's straddled the world of academia and policy, I'm only too aware that the practice of foreign policy is more often than not just dealing with stuff coming at you, and that the historian's idea that one can enter with the luxury of a predetermined view, I think, is frequently scotched by the reality of events, particularly given the horror show that we've had in the last couple of months. At the conference we both were at last week, the question came up whether history is in an accelerated period. Maybe that's something you might address. The question I have for you is, if I read you correctly, most of in the Anglo-Saxon model, at least in how it relates, history relates to contemporary decision making in the West, is towards a bias, probably towards a more cautionary position. The Vietnam effect, the effect of Iraq, etc. But your comments at the end about viewing China's view of history, Russia's view of history, makes me think that two very important leaders in the person of Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, those two individuals have a very centralized position, much more centralized position in policymaking than any of their counterparts in the West, but also a very, very sharp view of history. In China's case, history itself is actually the point of contention, certainly in relation with Japan. I wonder also whether that attachment to history is a kind of cognitive failsafe. It's a way for them, in their very centralized dealing with all this stuff coming at their way, it's a way of narrowing the view of the world that simplifies the act of decision making. Do you think there's anything in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly with China, I mean, there's a very clear and consistent point of view. I don't think China is particularly, unlike Putin, about trying to get everybody by surprise. I think China has made clear what it thinks are its rights, what it thinks are other people's obligations to China, and will probe and push to see how far it can get. And I think the framework within which we're operating with China is quite well understood. As a result of that, a lot of the uncertainties are more about the strength of the domestic position of Xi and the relationship between foreign and domestic policy. I mean, one of the problems that outside commentators often have is the assumption that all foreign leaders care about is foreign policy. And you know, that's what they're thinking about all the time. We're like all our leaders, most of the time they're worrying about managing what's beneath and below and around them rather than the external affairs. With Putin, I think it's different. I think Putin has the authoritarian leader's ability to be bold, and it's parallel. It's always, you know, bold leaders could always leave democracies appearing flat-footed. But my view of Putin would be that he's acted out of weakness rather than strength. He acted in Ukraine because he was losing a client, Yanukovych, and a country that he'd been trying to draw into the Russian sphere looked like going into the EU sphere, and with Assad risked losing one of the few other clients. And therefore, if he hadn't stepped in, the situation would have got worse rather than him stepping in to make the situation better. And I think it's got mixed results. I mean, Ukraine, I would still say Ukraine policy generally is a failure. Syria, I think it's too early to say that. It's certainly in the short term, he's got some benefits. But there is a difference. And of course, with Putin, one can see all the time the use of history, both to bolster national support. I mean, the return of a constant harping on the Great Patriotic War. And this is the great unifying moment of history, for the thing to which you always refer when speaking of the hardships and the importance of seeing them through. So history is used, in the same way, of course, China uses history a lot vis-a-vis Japan. These things are always available in order to mobilize opinion. But then more particular uses of history to explain, you know, why a great chunk of Ukraine is really Russian and hard to see why it's actually part of another country. So there's a sort of instrumental use of history, which is always the case. It's hard to work out what is cynically being used and what is actually quite genuine.
And I think the reality is there's bound to be a feedback within those those two things. We at the Institute have been very much occupied on this question, having produced recently an analysis on China's worldview, which examined exactly this question of the idea of history as destiny from a Chinese point of view. And from the Russian point of view, we had Kyle Wilson also with us recently, exploring his own particularist version. But I think the corollary of the over-cautionary bias is maybe in those two cases, it's perhaps the history as a self-fulfilling prophecy that runs the risk the other way. I'd like to open it now to the audience. Can you please identify yourselves? A microphone will come round, and please keep your question to the point.
Thank you. My name is Anthony Zui. I'm from the University of New South Wales. I really enjoyed your presentation and the discussion also of empathy and the different levels, looking at implementation. My question is about the often made statement about history, that it's written through the eyes of the victors, the winners. And my question is there a need, do you think, to make a particular effort to understand history through the eyes of the losers?
Mm. It's great. I mean, there was a famous comment to Churchill, wasn't it, that history will be kind to you, Mr. Churchill. Yes, it will, because I will write it. So in very, very particular ways it's written by the victors. Yeah, and I think contemporary history is much better because you've got the passage of time. It doesn't seem like treachery to ask questions about those who are on to the receiving end of Western policy as to how they felt about it and whether we over-egged it somewhat. And of course, you learn the mistakes of the losers, why people lost, what choices they had, how could they have set things off. I mean, and I mentioned the Japan, the sort of coming war. There was a particular war about the coming war with Japan. It was written in 1990, I think.
Yeah.
But actually, it took, if you looked at the reasoning, it was almost exactly the same as the Japanese reasoning of 1940-41, about being squeezed out of its markets, about the idea if you struck a blow against the United States, you could do a deal with them, and so on. So it actually sort of replicated the reasoning and left you wondering, well, you know, if it had turned out so badly for them in 1941, why do we think they'll try the same ruses again, as if they are totally incapable of learning from history. So yeah, I mean, I think it's all part of being empathetic. And if the losers are starting to be victors, or the losers are starting to grow in strength, becomes even more important. I mean, take it away from great power politics, it's particularly important given one of the most important events since 45 has been decolonization. So, you know, lots of countries that we occupy, UK particularly occupied, no longer fully independent. Those memories of occupation, of being colonies, are still incredibly important to them. So unless you understand that, you're going to miss out an awful lot on what's going on.
Also, sorry, just to very brief, not only think about the state losers, but maybe losers within a given state. So perhaps the most marginalized populations within the society and what one would learn from them.
A lot of people in Britain are wishing they'd paid an awful lot more attention at the moment because they got rather caught by surprise as these people took their revenge. A lot of people were brought up short by realizing that there's no point telling people how it's in their economic interests to vote in a particular way when they haven't seen any improvement in their economic position for the last couple of decades. It just doesn't work anymore. And when they've seen the 2007-08 financial crisis as well. So I think the need to be empathetic is a strategic virtue in all contexts. And for democratic politicians, it's particularly important. Wouldn't dare comment about Australian politics, but you're welcome to comment about British politics because it's in a shambles at the moment. And it's partly because a sense that at least one of the major political parties has completely lost touch with its traditional supporters.
I'll take a couple of questions together now. over here.
Thank you. My name is David Hodge from the Australian Defence Force. Your point there links quite nicely into my question, and that is you spoke about the Chinese and Russian examples of consistency in decision-making. Now, given our history, particularly within Australia, over the last couple of years, should we learn from their examples, I guess, in the terms of our election cycles and terms in government?
And the second question down here at the front.
Yeah, I'd like to maybe go a bit further back. We focused on the 20th century, but to maybe look at, we're sort of in the technology revolution, I would say, probably now. Can we draw comparisons to the Industrial Revolution and what's happening, and will it result in a benefit to society as a whole, or will we really see, well, for want of a better word, that the capitalists, industrialists are benefiting and that we're creating, which we do seem to be seeing at the moment, a two-tier society?
Gosh. Well, let me deal with that one first and I'll come back to that. Look, I mean, all our political systems have their curiosities. Say over in the UK, we sort of would look at the level of fratricide in the Australian system, but we seem to have matched it in recent weeks. So we can't mock that anymore. I think we have to hold on to the benefits of democratic political systems. They are slower, they are cumbersome, they are chaotic, but there are checks and balances. And the danger with a Putin, or increasingly a Z, is that the checks and balances are lost. By and large, in the end, authoritarian systems make worse decisions than liberal democratic ones. Or, they again use another Churchill line about the United States, it gets to the right answer after exhausting the alternatives. I think we can learn from each other's democracies, but I think what we learn from Russia is just relearn the dangers of authoritarian systems, which is with an elite looking after itself. I mean, the importance of Russia is it's a kleptocracy. What's interesting in terms of its future, whereas I think you'll still find a lot of people interested in the extent to which, going back to capitalists, I mean, they're becoming more and more wary about investing in China. They're completely convinced they don't want to invest in Russia because it's anything they earn will be confiscated. Especially at times like this, where we've got such funny elections going on in all our countries, in the United States, the funniest of the lot. Funny's not the right, funny peculiar rather than haha. We have to hold on to. I mean, the challenge is how to replenish liberal democracy, I think. And when the party systems themselves seem to have atrophied and lost touch with the origins, which leads me into that question, because they're products to some extent of the Industrial Revolution, the party systems of class warfare and so on. And we're in very different worlds now. And people have the Agricultural Revolution, Industrial Revolution, now the Digital Revolution is sort of the third wave. It is changing economic decision-making, economic power. You wouldn't have imagined 30 years ago that great concentrations of economic power would be in the hands of young geeks who understood computer hardware and software. Something could move into quite monopolistic positions quite quickly and easily. Meanwhile, a lot of other very traditional economic activity goes on. You have all now the discussion of robotics and so on. Now, how this, it's partly, I guess, what I was referring to when talking about the importance of looking at the micro, because these slow changes, not so slow, these changes in everyday experience do eventually feed up. And I think we do have a problem in developing political forms that do justice to the differences in expectation and experience that you get through society. I think the Trump phenomenon is different from the Corbyn phenomenon. They're all different, but there is a sense of large numbers of people who do feel a bit left behind and don't feel that any existing political party speaks to them, for them. And that I think is a challenge for all our politics. It's a challenge that we can address. I mean, you wonder, again, going back to the very authoritarian systems, which you would, you know, China, Russia, Turkey, now has to be added, how well they can cope with this, because at least we've got evidence now to which we can respond. But imagine being in a situation where you're just frightened of what's going on amongst your masses because you don't really know anymore.
One of the questions I lighted on, one of the phrases I lighted on when you said towards the end that history itself is not agreed. I'm going to be a bit provocative now because I know there are limits about what you can say about your involvement in the Chilcot report. But given that you've identified yourself as part historian, I'd just be interested in your thoughts and how you compartmentalised your own approach to that in the broader question of how does history get injected into the policy debate. This surely has to be one of the most interesting recent test cases.
Well, I mean, Chilcot was set up as sort of a lessons learnt inquiry. And, you know, the lessons, to some extent, were the bleeding obvious. It wasn't what we thought was important. I think what the report shows, this is not for reporting, by the way, if any journalists here, we just wanted to establish a record. Because events were so contested and myths had grown up that actually the first and most important thing, and the reason why it took so long, we said, well, this is as far as we can work out what happened. So the lessons that you want to draw, here's your raw material. We've drawn some for you. And there are lessons there, which I think are pertinent. But the section on lessons opens by pointing out the unique features of this case. And therefore, the care that's needed when saying, well, because this happened in Iraq, it must, you know, it's relevant to another case. You know, most obviously, Iraq was a case where we took the initiative. Well, the US took the initiative and we went along with and you went along with. But it wasn't like, say, the Falkland, which is the other thing I'd sort of done the big official thing on, where somebody else took the initiative and we were scrabbling to respond. This was something that we undertook, and that created its own questions for the inquiry, which is pretty obvious. So, as inquiries go, this is quite an academic one. In a sense, it concentrates on, you know, chronology and evidence, and pretty careful about drawing conclusions. And I think it's pretty useful in that regard. As a historian, it's a very different experience than just writing a book, because, you know, if you're writing a book, you'll take five files and you'll say, you know, sum it up in a couple of paragraphs and a little allusion so the knowing can pick out what you're trying to get out and a bit of inference. And you can't do that. You've just got to be, this happened and that happened. And be incredibly cautious about the conclusions you draw.
Thank you. We've got time for just one final question, if there's anyone who hasn't had a chance yet. Sir.
Hi, Ian Lynn, Quo Vadis. What is happening today is that the world is changing quite dramatically, and we need history to give us hindsight. And our hindsight can change, we change our perspective on how we see it. And that's what we need today. We need to combine our hindsight, all right, with insight to get foresight.
That's good.
And so our foresight is what we require now, because the world is changing so quickly, it will not be a continuation of the past. We all now have huge amounts of information, huge activities in which we can get nearly any knowledge we like, and what we need now is wisdom. And so we need to know all this history, but we need to see history from the eyes of Chinese history, Chinese eyes, at that point in time, and work out why it is different today to try and predict what that future will be. Because we use that prediction to decide today what we've got to do, because everything we do today will create our own future. And so we need to pull all of these things together, all right? And we need the wisdom, we need the foresight from hindsight and insight, and then we need a vision of where we're going.
Well, I think the starting point that hindsight changes is an important one. How we view events often depends on what stage we're at in the consequences and repercussions of those events. I mean, you can see that very much in how the end of the 1991 Gulf War is viewed. You know, initially it seemed to be, you know, very wise and limited and restrained. Then it seemed a bit foolish because Saddam was still there. Then, given sort of the, what happened in Iraq after 2003, it seemed wise again because all the reservations that had been expressed in 1991 seemed right. So hindsight changes. That's an important point. It's also true that information is not the same as wisdom. It's not the same as intelligence, even. The amount of information we've got now is in some ways problematic because you're constantly looking for ways to filter it, make sense of it. And this is one of the interesting questions with social media, point as to whether actually instead of the regular challenge of different perspectives, actually it's causing people to cluster and group around certain points of view rather than have that challenge that I think is essential to good policymaking and public debate. Prediction, the old line, it's pretty easy as long as you stay clear of the future. I've even looked back in the sort of commentating business and try to work out what I got right and what I mean, it's not a complete zero. I got some things right, and I think what you get right is when you can see the logic of a situation and you can work out the balances of power and interest within it, and you can follow it through, and you can see how things are likely to develop. Where prediction gets hard is in situations where there's just so many moving parts, so many factors can intervene. And one of the points I was going to make and have time for is one of the problems with the way we look at historical events is that we forget what else was going on at the same time. Forget that you look at Kennedy's decision making in Vietnam in the middle of 1963. And if you do that without forgetting what was going on with civil rights at the time, you don't understand Kennedy, you don't understand the decisions he's making. We tend to forget that. So the number of moving parts is one of the reasons that it's all so difficult. I used to, when I did comment even more regularly, I used to have a sort of standard article after any event, and it would start, in retrospect, it was inevitable, and would conclude, whatever else one can say, things will never be the same again. And this could serve you in all sorts of situations.
So Lawrence Freeman, to adapt a phrase, we may not be interested in the future, but the future is certainly interested in us. Thank you so much for dispelling some of the fogs of contemporary history in an accelerated phase. I think we'll all agree that whether on the cusp of an epoch change or not, it's certainly been an extremely busy, challenging and distracting time. And for helping to inject your clarity with masterful precision, we're extremely grateful to you, and I hope you'll remain a friend of the Lowy Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Lawrence Freeman.
Thank you.